Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
Methadone is often referred to by patients as liquid handcuffs. It's a life-saving medication, to be sure, but it can really dominate your life.
Loosening the liquid handcuffs by making methadone more accessible. People in recovery from addiction have been fighting that battle for decades. It's Tuesday, March 12th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, Miami Beach's crackdown on rowdy tourists is getting mixed reactions from locals who say the public breakup with spring breakers has made South Beach safer, but has also hurt businesses. And Nicholas Winton helped rescue hundreds of children from the Nazis. Portraying the hero in a new film was personal for Anthony Hopkins.
That was very much a part of my past, although I never experienced that kind of suffering. But I'd observed it at that young age, so it burned itself into my memory.
But first, for decades, we've known that two medications could help prevent tens of thousands of overdose deaths. But it turns out they're not as widely used as they could be, because they're hard to get, and they come with a lot of strings attached. Stat reporter Lev Fasher spent a year digging into how and why those treatments are restricted for our editorial partners at Stat, the health and medicine publication. He joined Scott Tong to talk about it.
So just a reminder of this crisis, about 80,000 people in this country die of opioid overdoses every year. You write that we have medicines to prevent deaths. What are they and what do they do?
There are two medications that are extraordinarily effective at preventing people from dying of opioid overdose. They're called methadone and buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is also referred to as Suboxone, a brand name. And essentially, when people try to quit illicit opioids, they feel really intense withdrawal. It's agonizing, it's painful. Folks can't really function when they're using fentanyl regularly and they suddenly stop. So what these medications do is prevent the withdrawal symptoms from setting in, but they leave people clear-headed and free to go about their lives. People who take buprenorphine are a little less than 40% less likely to die of an opioid overdose. People who take methadone are a little less than 60% less likely to die of an opioid overdose. So as you said, we've got 80,000 people dying each year of opioid overdoses, a little more actually. And when I was speaking to Nora Volkov, who is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, she estimated that universal access to these medications could save tens of thousands of lives. She said that our overdose death rates could be 50% lower if we just provided better access to these medications to people with opioid addiction who are seeking treatment.
Yeah. And Lev, let's just compare the use of these two medicines with the so-called cold turkey approach. What do you know about that approach?
Historically, in American addiction treatment, really regardless of the substance in question, the most common approach has been to just say no, so to speak, to encourage people simply to stop using. But physiologically, when it comes to opioids, that's not a reasonable ask to make of people. At this point, given how potent fentanyl is that people are buying on the street, there isn't really a way to just stop using without methadone or buprenorphine. It's extraordinarily rare if it happens at all. So these medications are really critical, critical components of our country's response to the overdose epidemic.
Yeah. And despite the numbers on how effective these medicines are, what you write is an access issue. And you describe the limitations people have as a conscious choice, you know, by different organizations in society. So let's talk about a couple of examples. How do methadone clinics limit access to these medicines?
So to answer that, I need to give a little context on how methadone is distributed, because it is a very tightly regulated medication. Actually, doctors can't prescribe it to patients as an addiction medication. They can prescribe it for pain, but as an addiction medication, people who want to use methadone as part of their recovery have to go to a specialized clinic. Often they have to show up every day to receive a single dose. They have to agree to participate in counseling and drug testing. And in many cases, these clinics impose rules and policies that really just don't fit patients' lives. And as you can hear, require an immense time commitment that can take away from other aspects of people's lives that can aid their recovery, like work or their family or their education. Mm. So there is increasingly a movement to loosen restrictions at methadone clinics. And many of them, to their credit, have become much more generous with what are called take-home medications, essentially giving people a week's worth of medication, and they only have to come in every Monday morning, for example. But there are still a number of clinics that treat patients very punitively, and this traces back to the methadone clinic system's roots in the early 70s and the Nixon administration and the war on drugs.
And Lev, as you write, there are limitations also at rehabilitation facilities, at pharmacies, at prisons and jails. For a moment, just help us understand, what is the strongest argument to limit access to make sure it doesn't get out too much?
Right. So one thing that's important to note is that both of these medications are opioids. Buprenorphine is what's called a partial agonist, so it partly binds to the same receptors in your brain that a prescription painkiller or even illicit fentanyl would. And then methadone is a full agonist, meaning it fully binds to those receptors. But of course, the fact that they're both opioids doesn't make them equivalent to these ultra-potent, dangerous street drugs that people are buying today. So nonetheless, there's still this resistance to the idea that the best thing to do for someone with opioid addiction is to prescribe yet more opioids. But I can't stress enough, buprenorphine and methadone are FDA-approved, highly regulated, pharmaceutical-grade medications. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you compare it to fentanyl, they're not even in the same ballpark.
All right. And just briefly, you spent some time with a woman named Rebecca Smith in Detroit. What did you learn from her story?
Right. Rebecca is really emblematic of a lot of the constraints and punitive measures that patients at methadone clinics can face. So in her case, she had been in stable recovery for 5 or 6 years, and she attended a celebration dinner for her grandson, who had graduated high school. At this dinner, she participated in some champagne toasts, just, you know, a couple sips of wine for someone who, I should note, has never had an issue with alcohol. And the clinic, when it found out about this, it stripped her of the 2 weeks of take-home medications that she had been getting. So she was going to the clinic just twice a month. She was picking up 2 weeks of medication. She was able to participate in her church life and see her family and very importantly, go to work. But of course, all of a sudden, when you have to be at a methadone clinic every single morning, all of that goes away. So she had to quit her job. Her story hopefully is an outlier. It's certainly not the most common experience that patients have at methadone clinics, but it is a very common one. And it's part of the reason that methadone is often referred to by patients as liquid handcuffs. It's a life-saving medication, to be sure. Mm-hmm. But when you are in treatment with methadone, it can really dominate your life. And again, there's increasingly a movement to make methadone available in contexts beyond methadone clinics, and just generally speaking, to loosen restrictions surrounding both of these medications so they can better get into the hands of people who need them.
Lev Asher is a reporter covering addiction for our editorial partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Lev, always good to have you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Scott.
There's a lot more coverage of the opioid crisis, as well as a ton of other stories, at our website, hereandnow.org. Coming up next, Miami Beach's public breakup with spring break has left some locals feeling jilted instead. Deepa Fernandez has more after this break, which is only a minute. We'll be right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Some locals are feeling conflicted about Miami Beach's public breakup with spring break. After a few rough years of vandalism, shootings, and drunken arrests, the city released a video announcing new restrictions to keep spring break under control.
This March, you can expect things like curfews, bag checks, and restricted beach access,
DUI checkpoints, $100 parking, and strong police enforcement for drug possession and violence.
But some business owners are worried about the impact the new rules will have on their lives. For more, let's bring in Veronica Zaragovia. She's a reporter with member station WLRN in Miami. And listen to those birds, folks. She's bringing us to Ocean Drive in South Beach. Veronica, hello.
Hi, Deepa. Thank you for having me.
I understand that many of these new spring break rules are already in place in Miami. What's it looking like right now?
It is quiet right now and we can hear the birds. But between 6 a.m. Thursday and 6 a.m. of Monday, a lot of restrictions go into effect to avoid the overcrowding and violence that has been taking place over the last several years.
Yeah, and remind us how wild spring break can get down there on Miami Beach.
You'll just see tons of people congregating, dancing. But then the problem is that there have been gunshots, and it's led to very dangerous stampedes. And then last year, two fatal gunshots took place, and that's when the city decided that they had to implement very strict rules ahead of time rather than wait and do things retroactively.
Okay. I imagine this is having an impact on tourism, because that's a huge part of Florida's economy. You spoke with David Wallach. He owns Mango's Tropical Cafe on Ocean Drive.
I totally understand the city's decisions in doing all of this, but when you talk about for a business, any business, not just my business, and all my staff, really, and making a living for their families, it's devastating.
Amina, that's a hard line to walk between keeping law and order and keeping your business open. We heard from some members of the Black Affairs Advisory Committee that they weren't consulted on the city's new campaign and that they believe the rules will send unwelcoming messages to Black tourists. What can you tell us about that?
This has come up in past years. Black officials and leaders will say that these measures come across as racist. But the response from the police chief, Wayne Jones, who's the city's first Black police chief, has been that the city wants tourists to come. Its economy depends on tourism. Just follow the rules and have fun, and then everybody is welcome here.
And we do know that there is a huge increase of police officers in the area, both on the beach and Ocean Drive. But can you tell me, is the messaging actually working and deterring tourists from visiting?
Yes, Deepa, I would say that it has been effective. I've seen it even on TikTok, where people will say, don't come down here because it really is, there's not much to do. Last weekend was very quiet and the police department told me that nothing noteworthy happened to report. No shootings and no stampedes.
That's Veronica Zaragovia, reporter with member station WLRN. She's joining us from Ocean Drive in South Beach. Thank you so much, Veronica.
Thank you so much, Deepa.
Coming up, Scott speaks with Anthony Hopkins about the new film One Life. in which he plays Nicholas Winton, better known as the British Oscar Schindler for his role rescuing more than 600 mostly Jewish children from the Nazis during World War II. That's after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Nicholas Winton is a name most Americans may not be familiar with. He was a stockbroker in London in the 1930s. But he was instrumental in the rescue of more than 600 children, mostly Jewish, from the Nazis in what was then Czechoslovakia in World War II. His efforts were largely unrecognized until he was asked to take part in a BBC show called That's Life in 1988, and that is when an extraordinary event occurred.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please? Mr. Winton, would you like to turn round?
Oh, and the entire studio audience stands up, and Nicholas Winton is reunited with the grown children of people he helped rescue and their descendants. Winton would later be knighted by the Queen for his war efforts and remain close to the survivors, who called themselves Nicky's children. And now his story is being told in the new film One Life, and it's only fitting that he is played by another knight, Sir Anthony Hopkins, who joins us now. Sir Anthony Hopkins, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. One of the producers of One Life, Ian Canning, said it was beyond our wildest dreams that you would read the script and then choose to play Winton. What drew you to the story?
Well, that documentary, the one you've just played, I hadn't seen it back in the 1980s, but I saw it when I think Nicholas's daughter wanted me to play him. So I read the script. It's so well written, and I think it was something personal for me as well, because I remember as a boy the first images of the concentration camp of Bergen-Belsen after the war.
Yeah,
I was in London with my parents, and I was a young boy, I was 6, 7 years of age. And I remember my father going into this photographic exhibition on a bright sunny morning, 1945. I waited outside, and he came out and he said to my mother, he said, "You wouldn't believe it, walking skeletons." And then we saw it on the newsreels, and photographs were released in the papers. So that was very much a part of my past, you know, although I never experienced that kind of suffering. But I'd observed it at that young age, so it burned itself into my memory. So when I got this script, I thought, well, this would be a wonderful way of closing the circle in a way, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's tell a little bit of the story for our listeners. Nicholas Winton was a young stockbroker in London. We see in the film he's compelled to go to Prague in what was then Czechoslovakia, and once there to bring Jewish refugee children out of these horrific ghettos there. They're on the run because the Nazis are coming after the Allies have ceded a part of Czechoslovakia to them. And Nicky Winton describes himself as an agnostic socialist with a background that is Jewish and German and Anglican. Yet his motivation, that's what I want to ask you about, it seems to me to come across as a kind of secular faith in humanity. What do you think drives him?
One of his interviews, when he was really late on in his life, 90s or late 90s. But he was interviewed by an American reporter. He said, "Do you believe there is a God?" And Nicholas Winton didn't want to be dogmatic. He said, "Well, look at it this way. Germany was praying for victory. Britain was praying for victory. America was praying for victory." So, and then he shrugged his shoulders. "So what can I tell you?" And then the same interviewer said, "Do you see any future for the human race?" He said, "No." Much to the shock of the interviewer, he said, "No hope at all." He said, "No, unless we learn to compromise. And if we don't compromise and listen to the other side of the argument, then we are doomed." That maybe all metaphysics is about compromise. How do we learn? Because we can all point fingers and saying, "Well, it's this." But that dark side of us is in all of us. It lurks waiting to wake up.
Well, this film to bring this back to a new generation of viewers, has you play the elderly Nicholas, and he is quiet, self-effacing. We have a little audio here from a scene where he's at lunch with an old friend played by Jonathan Pryce.
"It is incredible what you achieved."
"Oh, I don't think of it."
No. I mean it. Truly. I mean, you should be proud.
Oh.
Save one life, save the world, you know?
Well, it's nothing to brag about. I mean, look at Doreen and Trevor. They did far more than I did, and they took all the risks. I mean, they actually stayed in Prague.
You know, Nicky, telling people isn't bragging.
Telling people isn't bragging. And yet the Nicky you play, so many of the scenes, he's silent. I mean, he's going about his life as a retiree, bearing the moral weight, it seems, of the past. You know, it reminds me, Miles Davis famously said, "It's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play." And I want to ask you how you think about playing a silent Nicholas Winton, alone with the memories that haunt him. How did you think about that on the set?
Well, the script was so well constructed. And, you know, if you ask about the art of acting, I don't know what that's about. But, you know, I've been doing it a long time now, so I can guess my way through intuit. A very good general rule is to, I don't mean underplay, so that you're invisible, but temper it with a moderation. Because it's easy to show off and show what you can do and what you can't do and all that. The thing is to moderate. And so I've tried in my life through the years of work, of many mistakes, to say, do less. And I say that to myself all the time. Do less. Let the audience do the work.
Yeah.
Because the audience will read into the face and the expression. But if you start pushing it, the viewer is turned off. And viewers are much more discerning today. And, you know, in my own stage of life, I stay quiet because, not that I know everything, I don't know anything really. But I look at my own life and I think, well, I don't know how on earth I got here. I have no clue. I know that I'm pretty limited. So therefore, I think Winton must have had the same feeling. We are all limited. I mean, at the moment, we all think we're great and we're fantastic and all that, especially in this business I'm in. And I want to say, oh, shut up. We don't know anything, really. And we're all going to die in the end. And I think that's the pacifier at the back of it all, of all thinking. We have no idea.
Well, can I ask about the humble Nicholas Winton in the famous scene where he meets the survivors of the children he saved. And I find this really interesting. The producers of the film actually invited the real-life Nicky's children, real-life lives of those he saved and their children to play kind of themselves in the studio audience. And they didn't tell you, I gather, until the scene was filmed?
Well, they told me just before the rehearsal started.
Ah.
So they said, okay, roll the cameras. I just thought, well, just sink into it and, you know, don't act it. So when I turned around and saw them all standing, I mean, no acting required.
You can meet all of these people properly after the programme. In the meantime, Mr. Winton, on behalf of all of them, thank you very much indeed.
Well, I want to ask about the importance of having this film now, for people to see this film now, because, you know, in the world today, there are refugee crises everywhere in the Middle East, in Ukraine. You know, your co-star Johnny Flynn says, we are losing touch with the sense of decency that Nikki embodied. Yes. And, you know, it certainly seems taking in refugees seems very out of fashion politically right now in the UK, in the US.
But it has always been, hasn't it? You know, the world has always been in tumult. We think of these are the good old days or those are the better. The world's always been a place of tumult and chaos. I mean, the post-war years in Germany and France, I mean, there's another tragedy. I mean, thousands of people died after that, after the great conflagration was over. Thousands of people just died or starved. And the whole of Europe was rubble. And the man who started all blew his brains out. And for what? A dream, a colossal dream. And he led 80 million people into the abyss.
Yeah. Finally, as people, our audience, as Americans, think about watching One Life, what do you want them to think about, or what do you want them to ask themselves as they watch this?
Well, it's a contemplation and a meditation of what we are, what we all are, and the choices we make in life. I met a lady many years ago, a woman. Her name is Mrs. Ginsburg. She'd survived Auschwitz. And we had coffee in Los Angeles. And she said her vocation was to go around schools and colleges, not to preach or to ram doctrine down anyone's throats, but to say, just look at history. Just see what we are capable of, both good and bad. Mm. It's not pointing the finger and saying, yeah, they're evil. Or look, actually, it's looking in the mirror at ourselves, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to pontificate and preach, and then life as usual, business as usual, move on. But when we get fancy ideas about ourselves and about how everything should be, then we're in the nightmare world. Anyone who lives with certainty is doomed to hell. Stalin lived with certainty, so did Adolf Hitler. Certainty that they were right. And that's the nightmare. So when everyone starts shouting the odds, when they say in politicians, they say, let it be understood. Let me be clear. Oh, yeah? Really?
Yeah. The film is One Life, about the work of Sir Nicholas Winton, who saved 669 children from the Nazis at the start of World War II, and he is played by Sir Anthony Hopkins. Sir Anthony Hopkins, great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Gabrielle Healy, Kalyani Saxena, and Emiko Tamagawa. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Michaela Varela and Caleb Green. Our theme music is by Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. And if you like this show, make sure you're subscribed to Here and Now Anytime or following us wherever you listen to podcasts. We've got new episodes every weekday of the year, no matter what. Back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from Schwab. When it comes to managing your wealth, Schwab gives you more choices, like full-service wealth management and advice when you need it most. You can also invest on your own and trade on Thinkorswim, Schwab's powerful, award-winning trading platforms. Plus, you'll get low costs, transparent pricing, and 24/7 live help. Schwab understands it's your financial journey, and they believe you should have choices in how you invest. Learn more at schwab.com. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.